For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello, Monday Match Analysis listeners. Gil Gross here. First, I just want to say thank you, everyone, for listening to these podcasts throughout Roland Garros 2024. I have thrown an insane amount of shows at you, hours and hours of audio, and it's amazing to see that you guys haven't gotten sick of me yet. At least the numbers have shown that. You know, who knows? This is a two-parter here. I have the post-match analysis of Alcaraz Sinner, which I did immediately after the match. The Zverev-Rude match did not get its own post-match video on YouTube, but I kind of went over it before previewing the final between Alcaraz and Zverev, and that will also be in this podcast, so you can skip ahead to that if you're just interested in hearing my thoughts on the Sunday Alcaraz-Zverev final at RG, but I hope you enjoy the entirety of this one, which starts right now. Alcaraz takes it from down 2-1 via a fifth set to advance to his first ever Roland Garros final and take a 5-4 lead in the head-to-head against Jannik Sinner. Massive victory in what was a massive match. However, of all the times Alcaraz and Sinner have played, this had to be the nerviest, maybe even the most topsy-turvy. And you can make an argument through three sets, the lowest level of tennis, because of the tension that I think both players were feeling. Understandably, this is the deepest they've ever played at a major, and the previous two times they have played at majors, the expectations have not been nearly as lofty as they are coming into this match, which is essentially the winner is going to be the favorite to win the title on Sunday. Not to mention the fact there's just extra juice in this rivalry, and I think it does matter who's across from the net from you when you have this kind of budding rivalry. Anyway, tension was high, and you felt that both players were feeling the pressure. Alcaraz, from the very start, he was not himself early on in the match. Sinner gave him a huge level dip in the second set to kind of allow Carlitos back in. In the third set, Sinner started cramping. And as soon as that happened, Alcaraz took a nosedive. And I believe he did. The reason he did take a nosedive was because he noticed Sinner's physical issues, and that actually made him nervous. It made it impossible for him to hit a second serve return past the service line. You know, it was that kind of nervous. And then I thought going into the fourth, yes, Sinner was up 2-1, but the match felt so up for grabs because neither man had really found their groove, other than Sinner right out of the gates playing really well. So who is going to find that level? I felt Alcaraz got to that spot where he could free up and play with freedom and gumption as a result of spectacular moments, spectacular shot making paired with his incredible explosive movement that created these highlight reel magical moments that, in my opinion, gave a chance for Alcaraz to get the crowd engaged, smile, let out some positive energy. And that seemed to at least change the vibes coming from his side of the net. Whereas Sinner, particularly in the fifth set after going down a break early on, he spent large portions of this match frustrated. And I never felt again after the first set. I never felt he got fully in that flow state. While we're talking mental, before we get to all the more tactical stuff, I do think Alcaraz's composure in the third set deserves a massive shout out. I mean, he should not have lost that set. He knows that. But he went right back to work in the fourth. He was not dejected by his failures in the third set whatsoever. Deserves a lot of credit for that. And also, you know, everything I said in the preview about this being a more pressurized situation for Alcaraz. When I was saying, you know, US Open when he won in 22, Wimbledon when he won in last year, less pressure in those situations than this situation. So he had to deal with that pressure. It's just a fact of tennis, right? He did so very admirably down the stretch of the fifth set, tons of close service games. He's able to navigate through time and time again. And I'm going to get into detail as far as, especially in that fifth set, what are the things he did so well to kind of get himself over the edge in those service games. And lastly, he's got a very solid memory bank built up at this point in his career when it comes to winning fifth sets. He has been highly successful in fifth sets, and I do think not only did he probably feel like he was physically stronger, I think Alcaraz, when it's time for a fifth, he just, at this point, has a lot of good memories built up, and that helps. But I think what helped the most, moving on from the mental, more than anything else, the shot making. Shot making really mattered to me in this match, from my eyes. And sometimes it doesn't matter all that much. And I know shot making is a weird term, but I guess what I'm really describing for those who may not be on the same page about what is the definition of shot making, I'm talking about making shots that are at a high degree of difficulty, usually offensively. I mean, there's defensive shot making, but normally that's a counterattack. You're turning defense to offense. So making high degree of difficulty shots to create damage or to create winners. That's what I'm talking about when I'm saying shot making. And oftentimes, shot making does not decide tennis matches. There are brilliant shot makers on tour who are outside the top 50. Because, you know, one or two spectacular shots here and there, it's not enough. Doesn't get you there. It counts as 1 point. You hit a great shot, congrats, 1 point. You make an error on the next ball, that's an unforced error that would never be in a highlight reel and wasn't impressive at all in any way and wasn't a fun point to watch. Guess what? 1 point. That's why shot making doesn't always matter. But I think over the course of the match, Alcaraz was compiling enough moments and Sinner was not, for it to matter. Alcaraz had more venom in his shots. He had more ideas, sharper angles on the forehand cross court, more frequent drop shots, mixing in the serve and volley a little bit more frequently. But even from the back of the court, it's just, are you going to create something? A brilliant backhand down the line? Are you going to generate an incredible injection of pace from the back of the court in a forehand rally? There are all these different scenarios, and it doesn't look the same over and over again because that's not really the point with Alcaraz. He's able to produce so many different shots from so many different locations. But the point is, he was the one creating. He had the firepower. He had the ideas without full confidence on the ground strokes, which Sinner, for most of this match, didn't have, which means maybe playing to a little bit of a safer target, maybe a little bit slower than we're used to seeing him hit, maybe making a few more errors, but without the full kind of pure ball striking that we sometimes see from Sinner, where it's not necessarily creative, but it's so powerful and so relentless. You took that away, right? And suddenly Sinner's game looking very flat offensively. It didn't seem like there were a lot of ideas there for how to create damage compared to Alcaraz, who was finding it easily. And these conditions were very interesting. They favored offense. It wasn't easy to move. My thought on why it wasn't easy to move is because the clay was very dry, because the sun was out during the daytime, and it was slippery, and perhaps the players who had gotten used to wet clay from the rainiest Roland Garros that I can remember We're just not quite as used to moving on the more slippery clay, which is something that, you know, we certainly saw Djokovic struggle with against Cirundolo as well. But because both players were struggling at times with their footing, particularly Sinner, particularly when he was moving out to his forehand, because of that, a couple of things were true. One, I don't think Sinner felt comfortable playing patient, and he made far more unforced errors than usual because of that. And I do think a lot of it, more than I've seen in a long time, was actually shot selection stuff from Sinner. I thought, okay, you're kind of pressing a little bit. Well, why might that be? Well, you can't play conservatively. Alcaraz is going to punish you. And by the way, that's true the other way as well. When Alcaraz was making all these unforced errors early in the match, you think the same thing. Okay, well, Carlitos, he can't really just start to roll the ball in play because Sinner's going to smother him with his ground stroke power. So that's true both ways. But for Sinner, it took away the consistency edge that he, I'm not going to say he needs to have it in this matchup in order to win, but he should have it in order to win. And in general, Sinner's defense, other than his return, well, Sinner's defense and his return were the main reason why he built that early lead. There were other things that were really good on his end, but it was defense and return, and it was making Alcaraz play a ton of extra balls in addition to maintaining super high ground stroke speed with unreal consistency. But it was never the same after the first set movement-wise for Sinner. I don't feel like the extra balls continue to come back. Certainly the return of serves were there for portions after the first set, but I never felt like the defense was there after the first set. On the topic of shot making, there's one part of Alcaraz's game that I want to highlight in particular, and that's his backhand. He came up with so many spectacular backhands. I'm going to focus on the fourth and the fifth set, but mostly the fifth. I mean, so 4-5 in the fourth set, 30 all, Sinner serving. So Alcaraz is 2 points away from taking this fourth set, and Alcaraz hits an open stance backhand down the line from a pretty neutral position. Any kind of sensible coach would have said, you should probably go cross court on this ball. But he ripped it down the line and forced an error. It was scarily similar to the backhand that Alcaraz hit down break point at Indian Wells in the second set when he was already down a set. He would end up holding serve, winning the second set, forcing a decider. So I don't know if that's lost on most people, but you know, the most important shot of Alcaraz's win over Sinner at Indian Wells was an open stance backhand down the line that he hit from a neutral position to create. And arguably, same thing in this match, because he wins this point at 30 all and he breaks to win the fourth set. Fifth set, Sinner serving at love one, it is deuce. So Sinner hits a serve plus one forehand down the line approach. And this is a ball that Alcaraz is very far away from. Sinner's approach shot is into the open court. I think for sure Alcaraz is going to need to slice this ball because it's getting very low. Not only does he have to go a long way east to west, not only does he need to range to his left a very far distance, but this ball, this approach shot from Sinner was smartly short in the court. It was going to get very low on Alcaraz. You can't really hit an open stance backhand here because the ball just didn't have enough distance. So the contact point needed to be a little bit more out in front. He needed to step towards the ball. So he goes closed stance on the run, somehow doesn't slice, and passes Sinner on the cross court. This was a mind-blowing shot. Break serve to go up to love. In the next game, it's to love, 30 all. Alcaraz hits a great backhand down the line to open up that point, do the damage that would put him ahead and give him the 40-30 lead. At 3-1, it's deuce. Alcaraz hits a backhand down the line drive volley winner. Extremely well directed for a backhand swing volley to take it down the line with precision. That's a hard shot to be precise with. And it's also a hard shot because, like, who practices that? There are some WTA players who hit that, but that's a rare shot. And it was actually going wide. So if Alcaraz let it go, he also would have won the point. But I thought the likely outcome for a player less talented was that he would somehow mess that up, or that he would hit it cross court where Sinner was waiting. So those are a few really big point backhands, high degree of difficulty, big reward. Thought Carlitos's backhand was stunningly good. The cat and mouse points were also in Alcaraz's favor. This is another form of shot making for Alcaraz. Of course, the drop shot, of course, the lobs. And in the past, drop shots have been pretty well neutralized by Sinner with court position and ground stroke quality. If someone is hugging the baseline and hitting deep and hitting hard, there's really no opportunity to drop shot. But in this match, Alcaraz kind of forced his way to it. There weren't a lot of great drop shot opportunities for Alcaraz, but he was still willing to hit it, knowing that it probably wasn't going to be a winner, but that it might still win him the point. He was using the drop shot to set up his passing shots and his lobs, because Sinner, upon getting to the drop shot, oftentimes, with some exceptions late in the fifth set, was not really doing enough for that retrieval. You either need to redrop, or you need to try to hit it forcefully deep into a corner, particularly if you're able to hit the ball at a decent contact height. You want it as high as possible. You got to try to stick the ball as much as you can. Because of Alcaraz's speed, anytime you hit the ball deep on a drop shot retrieval, he's going to be there, right? You're not going to hit it by him. So probably more delicate redrops would have served Sinner well. You stay in front of the ball, and then you put the onus on Alcaraz, hopefully from a low contact point himself, to try to come up with something. What Sinner was often doing was this kind of, you know, floaty little chip, dig deep, and Alcaraz was lobbing him and passing him. There was also a huge turnaround in this match on Alcaraz's serve. Early on, Sinner was manhandling Carlitos' first serve. In the first set, he was treating Alcaraz's first serve like it was a second serve, which is probably the most common theme in Alcaraz losses. Like, when Alcaraz loses matches, usually his opponent started to read the serve and feel the returns really, really well. Anyway, Alcaraz served terribly in the third set as well. That was not a good serving set from Carlitos. And ultimately, the overall numbers won't look good. But the reason why the Alcaraz serve is a big story here for why he won the match is because by the time the fifth set came around, the cheap points started coming. 3-1. He's love 30 down. He makes three first serves in a row, two service winners, and a plus one overhead. Doesn't get his serve broken. Goes up 4-1. 4-2, it's deuce. Closes the game with service winner, service winner. 5-3, another game that goes to deuce. Trying to serve out this match in the fifth. Alcaraz gets four unreturned serves on 10 points played. Mostly slice serves out wide on the deuce. And Alcaraz, even with the unreturnables aside, started to get good width on his serve consistently. That was a big deal against a Sinner who wasn't moving that well. And the wide kick on the ad continues to be a nightmare for all opponents on clay. And he didn't use it enough early on, particularly just when he was serving out wide on the ad, just not getting width, not getting height. And he got much better in that department. Now, some of these service winners I'm talking about were returnable. Many of them Sinner should have put back in the court. And Yannick, if there is one thing that I think he was super frustrated about in the fifth, it was his return of serve. Meanwhile, I thought it was going to be Sinner whose serve would help make holds easier. I thought it would be Sinner who would get himself out of holes, out of jams, with some clutch serves. Yannick had a bad serving match, and that wasn't the case. And part of that was because Alcaraz's ultra-deep return position on clay is going to make it hard for opponents to get free points on serve. But also, Sinner did not help his cause by making just 56% first serves in for the match. He did have a higher win percentage than Alcaraz by a lot, 74% versus 66%. But still, with Alcaraz making so many more first serves than Sinner, he actually won more first serve points, 68 to 56. There was a sudden dip in Sinner serving in the second set. He was up a set and a break. He double faulted in the game that Alcaraz got his first break to shift the momentum. His first serves wasn't good throughout that game either. Then in the third set, Sinner served woefully but got away with it because Alcaraz kept dropping second serve returns short to be attacked. The only set I felt Sinner served well was the fourth, besides the first. And the serving was fine in the first by Sinner. It wasn't spectacular. But in the fourth set, there were a lot of good service games from Jannik. But at 4-5, when he went up 30-love, we've already talked about that 30-all point with the great backhand, but when he went up 30-love in this game, he missed three out of his four first serves to get broken. And then in the fifth, Sinner served 54% in. So this was just not a good serve performance by Jannik. Some positives to be taken away for Sinner. Making, you know, every return at the start, making a lot of extra balls, playing with incredible pace on rally balls without making a lot of unforced errors, building that consistency advantage. That was the blueprint for Jannik to win the match, the consistency advantage on clay that Jannik would have actually liked, obviously, to be moving better on so that he could feel more comfortable defending and staying in points against Alcaraz's firepower, where instead Carlitos's shot making and his creativity and what he brought was bringing off of both wings was basically finding a way through Jannik quite easily and forcing Sinner to be more aggressive in his own game, mitigating that consistency edge. The other positive for Sinner is that he was taking on the high loopy ball, not letting it push him back. It was obviously Alcaraz's plan in the beginning of the match to do what he did in the third set at Indian Wells, to throw up a lot of high heavy balls. Sinner was ready for it, and he took it on the rise. He was kind of leaping off of his right foot on the backhand to try to gain leverage over the ball and make sure to kind of get on top of the ball in terms of his center of gravity off of that. And the variety that Alcaraz was throwing at Sinner didn't create a ton of chances or errors, in my opinion. It was really when Alcaraz, I think, stopped thinking about tactics so much and started playing his brilliantly varied offensive game that he ended up being at his best, ended up overpowering a Jannik Sinner who did not get the better of the consistency battle, did not get the better of the serving battle, and was overpowered by Alcaraz's spectacular offensive repertoire. Hey everyone, Gil Gross here, and it is time for a preview of the 2024 Roland Garros men's final between Carlos Alcaraz and Alexander Zverev. The winner will be winning Roland Garros for the first time. They are both first-time finalists. Alcaraz goes for slam number three. Zverev goes for the enormously important slam number one. Obviously, as you can...
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Your wedding will be one of the happiest days of your life. And Blue Nile can help you celebrate it with a gift that'll last a lifetime. Whether you're looking for wedding bands, a gift for your partner, or an unforgettable thank you to your bridesmaids, Blue Nile offers a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price, plus expert guidance to ensure you find the perfect piece. Experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999 at BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hell by now, no Zverev versus Rude post-match. I could have done one. Would have been about 6 minutes long, and I thought it would be a better idea to just start with that in this preview since I haven't covered it. So real quick on Zverev versus Rude, which for the second year in a row was a very unfortunate, forgettable semifinal with one player compromised, which was Casper Ruud due to a stomach issue. Now, in the first set, Casper looked really, really good. His forehand was at the peak of its powers. He was hitting some really great backhands down the line, which is, of course, a key for Ruud always, but even more so when he's playing Zverev. And movement-wise, he looked like lightning around the court. He was absorbing everything, even with Zverev hitting pretty big, really, from the start of this match, which is something that he would continue. But the one thing about the first set is Zverev missed a ton of first serves and a ton of backhands. And if there's one thing Zverev just never does, it's miss a ton of first serves and a ton of backhands. So after the opening set, I was thinking, okay, as good as Ruud looked, that set probably didn't tell us much about how the rest of the match is going to play out, because there is no way that for two more sets, Sasha is going to play that poorly on what are usually his two greatest strengths. But unfortunately, Ruud did start to slow down after that opening set because of the physical issue. Anyways, you know, Zverev did start to play really commanding on those backhand and backhand exchanges. Ruud's backhand down the line fell off. Zverev started timing his. And, you know, the height and the spin on Ruud's cross-court backhand, which is, by the way, like the spinniest backhand on tour, I think among two-handers. I don't know if he beats Gaz K in the spin department, but there's definitely no two-hander who hits with more topspin than Casper Ruud. And that protects his backhand. Even if he's hitting it at a lower speed, because of the way the ball jumps off the court, it's more difficult for opponents to attack. And when Ruud hits his backhand cross court, he relies on that topspin to be effective, not only so that he can stay protected, but also so he could look it for a forehand on the next ball. But against Zverev, as we've talked about on multiple occasions in analyzing Zverev's matches in this tournament alone, including just discussing the effect of Nadal's cross-court forehand, when it goes into that backhand, it's the strike zone for Zverev is so high, and he's 6'6", but even if you get it shoulder level, it doesn't matter. So you just can't make any progress there. And it was the same as what it looked like against Nadal's cross-court forehand, where Zverev's backhand, he started hammering it down the line off of balls that nobody could really do that with. It's way better against Zverev to keep it low because he can't get it high, but Ruud doesn't really do that. It's better to be like Daniil Medvedev and hit your backhand flat as a pancake versus being Ruud. Ruud's serve strategy was also neutralized by Zverev's backhand, especially on the ad side, because Ruud on clay especially, he uses this extreme wide serve position. So he stands in his backhand corner almost when he serves, which is really smart against most opponents, because you essentially just can't get it to Ruud's backhand. Like he's going to hit a forehand on the plus one every time unless you hit an exceptional return. And I think the number is 90% Ruud hits a first ball forehand off of his serves, but that might be off of both sides, which means on the ad side, it's probably like 95%. Anyway, again, Zverev can crush backhand down the line returns from his deep backhand corner. And he can also sting the ball cross court with the kind of pace that might actually be successful in getting it to Rude's backhand. So I think Casper was hitting way more first ball backhands than he normally would. And ultimately, it's like Rude's serve strategy goes to Zverev's stronger return. It's probably better to serve Zverev's forehand. But when you're standing all the way out wide and you try to serve T, it ends up not being a very effective serve because it's moving right into Zverev's forehand. So, you know, Zverev's forehand return isn't so bad that he's going to miss easy serves that are going right into his strike zone. Zverev's serve, it turned on. Last two sets were incredible from Sasha on his serve. He served 80%. Rude couldn't apply any pressure on the return. The 1-4 serve points by Zverev, so serve points between 1 and 4 shots, he won 45-5, and 4 points were double faults. So essentially, Zverev got tons of free points and never missed a plus one ball. And Rude was never able to force an error off the return. The big question, though, was like, would Zverev return to his confident ball striking? Would it look again like it looked against Nadal in the first round? Would it look like it did in Rome, where the forehand was coming off big and aggressive and he was accelerating through it and he was flattening it out? And the answer is yes. I thought Zverev hit the ball probably the best that he has in this match since his first round match. I think so. So that's a real positive for Zverev coming into this final. But the one thing I will say is there was another display of second serve nerves in the third set in a big 30-all. Actually, he was up 30-15, and he was trying to close out the set at 5-4, and he hit two ugly double faults in a row. When I say ugly, I mean he didn't miss by an inch. He didn't serve at his normal speed. No, the arm just got paralyzed, and he hit slow second serves halfway up the net. That's what I'm talking about. So that happened again. Let's go to the preview. Carlos Alcaraz versus Alexander Zverev. Head-to-head is 5-4. It is a weird one. Zverev got two wins when Alcaraz was quite underdeveloped, outside the top 30. Both of those matches were in 2021. So I kind of like to throw those out if we're looking at, okay, how have they really stacked up when they're on more even footing as far as how good they are as overall tennis players. And at that time, Zverev was just a far better player. And then, you know, it starts to look more favorable for Alcaraz. Perhaps, you know, you look at that as a 4-3 edge. And the way Alcaraz has won all four times against Zverev have been blowouts, like obliterations, honestly. None of them have been close at all. But it's crazy to look at that. You have two straightforward wins over a player. But then the other three matches, Zverev won. Alcaraz lost. Zverev had also wins at two slams, including the Australian Open this year. So, you know, I don't know what my big takeaway is on their head-to-head, to be completely honest. Like, big picture, I just think it's been very strange. You know, you can look at last year where Zverev had, you know, a scheduling issue in Madrid a couple of years ago, and then last year maybe he wasn't at his best yet. What about Indian Wells this year? You know, there's no real good explanation for why Zverev couldn't be competitive in that one. But then again, you have Zverev also beating Alcaraz on multiple occasions, including in big matches. So let's get into kind of what went down in those matches on both ways. We'll start with Alcaraz. So first off, there were some really bad tactical mistakes that Alcaraz made in Australia. His approach to the match for me was way off in a multitude of ways. I'll talk about some of those ways. Now, I'm assuming he corrected many of these things when they played at Indian Wells earlier this year. But that was the week I was calling the Phoenix Challenger. Never got to catch that match on replay. So full disclosure, I didn't see that one. But in Australia, Alcaraz was playing with far too much straight line pace that Zverev was really enjoying just redirecting. every ball coming in hard at a comfortable height, and Sasha was meeting it with his own baseline power. So Alcaraz just needed to mix it up more. He needed to play with more variety. And not only that, he needed to direct that variety at Zverev's forehand, because at the Australian Open, he played like he had no idea who was on the other side of the net as far as his baseline directionals. And, you know, I do think that that comes down to Alcaraz's confidence. That's a nice way to put it. Hubris, that's maybe a more negative way to put it, but maybe more accurate, because, you know, I saw Federer used to do the same thing all the time, where sometimes he'd play an opponent who had kind of a strength and a weakness, but they're so confident in their own games and how they play and what they can do with, you know, their magical abilities, that they that they basically just ignore the other side of the net and back their own games. It's better to swallow the ego. And for Alcaraz, that means fearing Zverev's backhand a little bit. And directing variety into his forehand, that means high loopy balls off of both wings, just like he was trying to execute against Sinner. That means some backhand slice down the line at Zverev's forehand. Now, we always talk about getting the ball low using the backhand slice, but how do you get the ball low when you're hitting a forehand? You hit the short angle. You try to roll the ball short in the court and get some good angle on it, and I think that's a really good play against Zverev to make him hit up on the forehand. If you're going to make him generate pace from low contact points, that is where you make him lift, you make him hit that higher bouncing ball that isn't as penetrating. That's the ball you can attack. That is really the goal here, because hitting variety at Zverev, it's not going to make him, it might make him miss, but really what it's going to do is it's going to give you balls to attack. Whereas hitting the ball in a straight line with a lot of pace at his backhand, you're never going to get anything to attack. Good luck getting something short. Good luck getting him to miss. Good luck getting him to drop the pace off. None of those things are going to happen. You want to make Zverev make his own pace and hit from either down low or up high. Now, those are the adjustments, or some of the adjustments, that I think Alcaraz will need to make from the Australian Open match. Again, maybe he already made them at Indian Wells, but you kind of get where I'm coming from there. Then there are things in this head-to-head that I think have consistently worked extremely well for Alcaraz that he'll want to repeat. One being that Zverev leaves the drop shot open because he likes to retreat far behind the baseline. And I'm thinking about their Madrid matchups in particular, where Alcaraz just feasted off of drop shot success, taking advantage of anything short off of both wings by frequently using the dropper. I also think that Alcaraz's deep return position on the first serve is very effective against Zverev's serve style, a style that brings S-tier pace, S-tier percentage, but just average spot serving. Now, what Zverev will want to do to counter that against a deep return position is to try to hit those sharper out-wide angles, but it's not Zverev's strength. And if you look at Zverev's career ace rate, it's 10.5%. But when he has played Alcaraz in every match after 2021, so you take away the two matches when Carlitos was a little baby, if you take away 2021, Zverev has been under 8% ace rate in every match except for Turin, which is the fastest court on the entire tour. Under 8% in every match, even though Zverev's ace rate is 10.5%. I also really like the block return option for Alcaraz. Zverev is known as a big hitter, but it's just like what we talked about with the baseline variety. He's a big hitter when he has pace to work with. He is not a great pace generator if you take all the pace off the ball, if you deaden that ball. So Alcaraz from a deep return position is also going to be in good defensive position, getting into the center of the court for his split step and giving Zverev a ball that he doesn't have a lot of pace to work with. I feel like that's a great way for Alcaraz to get in the point on Zverev's first serve. Off the second serve, it's also an area where at times Alcaraz has had a ton of success against Zverev. And certainly at the U.S. Open last year, it was actually from standing really, really close and taking a lot of time away and just jumping on Zverev, making him hit the big second serve. Because when you stand deep, Zverev is comfortable just rolling the second serve in and starting the point. But if you stand up on the baseline and attack Sasha, that's where he starts to get uncomfortable. And he starts to go big on the second serve, and you can get some double faults. I'm going to be curious to see where Alcaraz stands on the second return, but my bet is that over the course of the entire match, we'll see multiple return positions from Alcaraz. Let's move on to Zverev now. Where has Zverev had success against Alcaraz in his wins? Well, the biggest thing is he is way more steady. He misses from neutral far less than Alcaraz. If you take their semifinal matches, just as an example, little microcosm, there was one set that Alcaraz played against Sinner where he made 9 unforced errors. That was set 4. That was his lowest total. The other 4 sets were double-digit unforced errors. Zverev played 4 sets against Rude. He never ventured into double-digit unforced errors. And there were 2 sets in there where he made 4 unforced errors. So Zverev is the kind of player where you might go an entire set and barely get any mistakes from him, any easy mistakes. You might get, you know, 2, 3, 4, which feels like nothing over the course of a set, where Alcaraz is not really going to bring that to the table. Now, I talked about that being an advantage for Sinner. So let's just address that part of it because I thought Sinner would have that advantage. And obviously, if you look at the numbers, the unforced errors numbers, Sinner did have that advantage. However, I don't think Sinner was moving well enough to stay in the points and really take full advantage of being the steadier player because he wasn't able to extend rallies with his defense. I believe Zverev is going to move and defend much better than Sinner did. I think Alcaraz is going to face a stiffer test in that department, not because Zverev is generally a better mover and a defender than Sinner, but because Jannik seemed to be a little bit off in that department off after the first set. And I don't know if that was because of fatigue, because of slippery clay, or because of the hip and his preparation, a combination of that being weaker or whatever. I don't know which of those 3 things it was. I'm kind of leaning fatigue. I don't know. And slippery clay. But maybe all 3. I don't know. Point is, I think Zverev's going to move better, and that's going to help him actually flesh out any advantage that he may have in terms of his ability to play long rallies without missing, play a lot of balls without missing, which he does better than Alcaraz. There's also, of course, the serve return dynamic, which is another form of putting more balls in play when you think about it, which is that, you know, Zverev against Alcaraz's serve is very likely to hit a lot of clean, deep, neutralizing returns. Now, there's a big range in Alcaraz's serve. Like, sometimes he can serve better than expected, like, you know, really, really well. But I'd say if Alcaraz has an average serving day, Zverev will have no problem making a lot of returns. Of course, on the Zverev end, he is going to serve a high percentage of first serves at an extreme pace, and that's going to result in a lot of service winners, likely. And that puts a lot of pressure on Alcaraz to outplay Zverev off the ground from the back of the court. Pretty simple stuff. I won't go further than that. I mean, the serve return dynamic inherently does favor Zverev, although I do think there are things that Alcaraz can do to mitigate it. And the way that Alcaraz really draws even in this department is by being more deadly on the plus one than Zverev is on his plus one. Therefore, for Zverev to win the short points, he does need to win the battle of unreturned serves or the battle of cheap points. Otherwise, Alcaraz could actually build an advantage in those short bang-bang rallies. Last thing is backhand to backhand. It does feel like Zverev, in the matches that he's beat Alcaraz in, particularly the 2 slam matches, Australian Open and Roland Garros last year, where Zverev has had that cross-court on lock, and he has rushed and, you know, overwhelmed Alcaraz with the stability The depth, the pace. It's more solid off of the backhand, and I think both players are equally as dangerous. Will be interesting because Alcaraz hit his backhand, has been hitting his backhand, I think, extremely well, but Zverev usually wins that cross court when he's having any semblance of success against Alcaraz. Physically, I think both will be perfectly ready to go five sets. No advantage physically, in my opinion. I'm calling that a tie. And now let's get to the mental. Now, before this tournament, I picked Zverev to make the final because I felt he was playing great tennis. I picked him to lose in the final because I don't trust his ability to play his best in these kinds of matches. And it's not just about U.S. Open 2020. U.S. Open 2020 was bad, and that is a source of deep scar tissue heading into this match. Don't get me wrong. So it's a factor, but that's not the only thing. It would be unfair on my end if I looked at just one match in his entire career and made judgments about his ability to win a slam final based on one match. That would be totally unfair, and it's not where I'm coming from. But I've been watching Zverev for 6 years now, and I've seen patches of poor nerve management in tight scoreboard situations on a regular basis. It's been a constant, and it's even popped up during this tournament. Whether it be tight second serves, tight forehands, or an overall kind of passivity in his play. Alcaraz has not been perfect at dealing with pressure in his career either, but that's manifested itself in longer-term dips in form. It has not manifested itself in scoreboard-related faux pas, especially when Carlitos is feeling confident. When he's going right, Alcaraz, he's a fantastic big match player. He is 14-4 in his career in finals, 2-0 in major finals. He's got the five-set confidence factor, being 9-1 in his career in fifth sets. He's got a great tie break record in his career of 61-38. And Zverev's is also excellent, but it's not quite that good. The biggest mental factor of it all, though, is the two slam advantage for Alcaraz. I mean, the toughest one to get is your first. There's no doubt about it. And usually I'd say the favorite in the match has the pressure in a major final. And that's Alcaraz. Like, Alcaraz is the favorite to win the match, but somehow, does it feel at all like there's more pressure on Alcaraz? Not to me. Feels like there's way more pressure on Zverev because he is, as of now, one of the best players, if not the best player of all time, who has never won a slam. And he hasn't even gotten himself in these positions often enough because he hasn't done a great job of beating elite players at slams in best of five, not nearly as well as he's done this very same thing in best of three set events. Even at events like the Olympics and Masters 1000 and the year-end championships, just hasn't been quite the same at majors for some reason. So he has that scar tissue. He doesn't have that comfort factor of having already done this before. And that's where Alcaraz has the clear mental edge on top of everything else when it comes to Zverev's history. Prediction. These are two players who can show a wide range of levels, and that does make it somewhat difficult to know what to expect coming into this match. I think skill-wise, they are close to even at their best, which might sound weird considering just how spectacular Alcaraz is in all areas of the game, but you have to remember how unplayable Zverev's serve can be. So I would give Zverev that title of having the ability, even when Alcaraz is, you know, at a high level, to be in his zone, you know, to match him. Now, obviously, you can tell I favor Alcaraz mentally, and I've already said as much. And it's, you know, to me, the 5-4-30-all short ball test. 5-4-30-all, you have a cross-court forehand from your opponent that lands a little short in the court. Are you willing to gun it? Are you going to hit a great aggressive down the line that is going to tilt the point in your favor, and are you going to finish? Or are you going to trade it back cross court with some level of passivity? that's where I just trust Alcaraz a whole lot more. Another factor I want to mention is Ferrero. He wasn't there to keep him on track in Australia, and Alcaraz, tactically speaking, drifted way off track. This should be different. He has Juan Carlos Ferrero there. So I feel like if Alcaraz executes good tactics, plays cleaner than he did against Sinner, because he does need to just tighten things up a little bit against Zverev, who, again, I think will defend better and make more balls, I think the blueprint is there for Carlos Alcaraz to use his offensive arsenal, to play bolder and more aggressive in the big moments, to make return of serves with a deep return position, potentially a block return. And my pick is Carlos Alcaraz in four. Hope you enjoy the final, everybody. Don't forget to subscribe. Hope you enjoy the video. I'll see you next time.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.